Hello and welcome to Watch the Throne. What a lovely day. This is episode 3, That Thing You Do, from 1996. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us today, we have the first guest of this podcast, a permanent fixture now on the Cage Club Podcast Network, someone who has never been on one of our other podcasts, but I hope he will come back again and again, co-host of Now and Again, and host of an upcoming show or two that you will find on our network early next year, Nico Vasillo. Hello, Nico.
Hey, guys, what's up? Thanks so much for having me. This is very exciting. No one's ever asked my opinion on any actress before, so this is, I'm starting with a good one. This is, I'm feeling it.
I am so happy that you're here. I'm so glad that you are here to talk about Charlize. More importantly, sort of your other baby, your number one baby, music, is all throughout this movie.
Oh, yeah.
So we really want, you requested two movies. We want to make sure we got you on this one. Like I said, no pressure, but you're the first guest on Watch the Throne, so you are setting the bar for opinions and commentary and thoughts on Charlize outside of just me and Mike.
Okay, I'm gonna make sure that I set the bar unreasonably high for other guests.
You want to make sure if they hear you on here, they want to go over to your other show and hear you on there as well. So
there's nothing I like more than a false sense of superiority in life. So I really need it right now. So I'm going to bring it and give it everything I got.
So the important thing to note about That Thing You Do, I think we mentioned it last week on our 2 Days in the Valley episode, is that we watched the director's cut, the Hanks cut, because this is written and directed by Tom Hanks, who people are still yelling at us to do for a podcast. But like, relax. He's always good. It's going to be boring.
It did take us this long to get to Hanks in a film, though. I'm a little surprised.
It did. I was also surprised when I looked it up that he's only directed 2 films. He did this, and he did Larry Crown.
Have you seen Larry Crown?
I have not, no.
I have not either.
Larry Crown. You might understand why it was his last film. But I mean, it's not the worst.
Okay.
It's okay. But.
So what I read was that he wrote this movie while doing press tours for Forrest Gump and was just bored out of his mind. So he wrote a movie and then directed the movie. So that's pretty cool. But the important thing I was saying is the important thing to note about this is we're watching the director's cut, the Hanks cut, which is almost 2.5 hours long, which when you think about a movie about a boy band from the 1960s and how there's already like an hour and 40 minute theatrical cut out there, 2.5 hours feels a little excessive. But the reason that we did it, for some reason, surprisingly to us, most of that new footage that they add in is with Charlize Theron. So it's important for this show, but I know that at least one of our people on this podcast, our guest, wink, wink, hint, hint, wasn't thrilled with the fact that there is so much extra footage, kind of at times weighing down the movie.
I'll be real. I watched it with my husband, who is he's my partner in crime, and he is the most fun person I know, and we just kept calling it That Thing You Do plus that weird cuckolding art film that they snuck in, where this really handsome, inexplicably bright orange doctor is seducing this young, dumb blonde girl while her boyfriend becomes famous, and like, you could almost see it in his eyes, he might be getting famous, but I've got her now, and like... It was really weird and uncomfortable. It was, they snuck in this cuckolding art film, and it makes me wonder what other random side characters have extensive footage out there. Like, yeah. I'm starting to wonder if Guy's family has, like, some sort of dark American Beauty-esque sequences all taking place at the appliance store. You know, there's this really dramatic moment where he kills the rest of his family, and then he's just, like, putting the same record on every single stereo again, and it's not even the same record, but he's just walking through there going, "That thing you do!" And, like, it's really... Like, I'm sorry, but it had no purpose being in this film. None of this. Why did he take any of this? Why did he direct any of this? I felt a certain way.
It's like a methodical removal of everyone in this movie who is not thrilled by their success. In the early on in the movie, when they play the first gig, when they play the first time live, literally everyone in the auditorium is losing their mind except for Charlize. Mm-hmm. And so she's gone. And then when they actually get on the radio later and they're all excited and they all meet at the appliance store, the family could not care. The mom's kind of happy, but it's like, we're gonna kill each and every one of you one by one because we're only leaving people left in the world who love the Oneaters.
Well, the dad has had it out for his son, like, from the jump of this movie, leaving the sign on and cooking the books wrong and just not serving the customers up and everything. But there's just, I just imagine, you know, he shot a movie's worth of footage for each storyline or even each character. Like, yeah. I'm sure there's stuff at Disneyland with the bass player and the Marines that could go on for like another 20-30 minutes. Even.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
I kind of liked a lot of the new stuff, but then again, to be honest, like, originally, when I first saw this, I wasn't a huge fan of this movie, and like every time I watch it, I kind of become more of a fan of it.
It's a great movie.
It is. Like, I understand that at this point, but I just really enjoyed, like, because I like the movie so much, all this extra stuff. I was very baffled by a lot of it. I'm not going to contend that whatsoever. There's just something so, like, crazy to see behind the mind of Hanks and, like, all this other stuff that's on his mind while he's making this that he wants to explore. It's very weird. And
it explains David Pumpkin.
You're right. Like, it is, like, this other movie going on while this movie is really happening.
I need to point out, you said something about the dad having it in for his son. Does anybody else make the connection between that archetype, angry, kind of, like, red from that 70s show, cranky dad, with Hemingway heroes? I feel like they're the modern equivalent of the Hemingway hero, and he's got that very left impotent by war. What is Tom Hanks getting at with this film? It's got this very left sort of impotent by war, not capable of functioning as a happy person, and he even sings the song wrong, which is a trope you see a lot. Like, you saw it in the first season of Modern Family. One of the characters has a boyfriend who's very stupid and sings a song that starts really romantic and then turns into I Just Want to Do You. And the outro of the episode is everybody singing their version of the song. Ed O'Neill's character is like, he sings like a 50s version of it, essentially. I'm going to see if I can get through this podcast without singing.
Well, I mean, how weird is it just that he replaces his son, the drummer, with the original drummer of the band?
Yeah.
So he's got, like, this surrogate son working for him at the store while his real one's getting famous.
Happy Days taught me this is normal.
What's also weird to me about sort of the take on masculinity in this movie is that one thing that was in the extended version, not in the theatrical version, is that Tom Hanks' character, Mr. White, has a boyfriend.
Oh.
He's dating Howie Long.
It's a gorgeous Howie Long from the 90s. Gorgeous Howie Long from the 90s. Where was this when I was watching this when I was a kid? I would have been much more into this movie, and I was already pretty into this fucking movie.
Dude, that was the weirdest. Like, even I, who don't watch sports, like, knew it was him, and I was just distracted by it. I was like, oh, I like the character development, but I'm a little just put off by the comedy angle of it all. Like, here's this football player here. It was kind of funny.
What's also really funny is that, like, you know, that's when we only see him in, like, that one scene, I think, and it's when Guy shows back up to the hotel really drunk. We're getting way ahead of ourselves, but, you know, he sort of follows Tom Hanks to the car, and he's just like, well, I'm coming with you, and Howie's like, bring him. And, like, I want to see, like, that night where, like, he goes out on the town with them, and, like, I wonder if that was also shot, like, as an alternate take.
I need that to be a really dark, dramatic sort of gods and monsters kind of film.
Here's a quick rundown on the other extended edition differences. That first scene where Charlize goes back to make out with Guy, because she is dating the main guy, apparently Tom Hanks did not want to cast because he looked too much like a young Tom Hanks.
Exactly. Like, I thought that's why you cast him, because he's playing young Tom. He's basically doing an impression of young Tom Hanks the whole movie.
This is young Tom Hanks self-insert fanfic that he wrote about himself.
But Rita Wilson, his wife, who's also in this movie, said, no, he's cute. We're going to cast Tom Everett Scott in this movie. And Tom Hanks is like, all right, like, Rita, if you want it, we're going to go with that. So Charlize goes back to his place, and they have that extended makeout scene where it's kind of the closest to being objectified that she is in this movie, but at least compared to, you know, the last two movies, I was like, oh, like, I don't feel uncomfortable about this. Like, she's kind of in control of this, and, like, you know, she's positively using her sexuality, and, like, I don't have to feel uncomfortable about, like, upskirt shots from a horror movie or needless topless scenes from a subpar crime thriller.
Yeah, I will say this, and even without all of those extended scenes with her rendezvous at the dentist, like, I feel like she's actually a character here, like, that they've, like, Hanks is actually able to create people in his movies, like, that feel like they're real people and could actually exist. And yeah, and, like, kind of right from the beginning, you're like, I don't know, these two really are going to last or anything. She seems to have different priorities than him. He kind of just, he's more of like a beatnik that wants to make out, and I guess she's looking for stability. But you're right. Like, yeah, she definitely knows what she wants and is going for that and isn't going to let Guy try and smooth talk her into the bed because it's been their 1-year anniversary.
Wait, I'm so sorry. I have to ask a question. I have to know how bad the objectification was in the first two films. Oof. That you didn't feel that it was objectifying when people were sticking their fingers in her mouth.
Well, that's... Okay, so that's another scene. We're going to get into the dentist scene later. So the first movie she was in was like, it was a featured extra role. She had no words. There was just some unfortunate camera angles that left her sort of like corn tendrils like wrapping around her legs and like an upskirt shot.
Yeah, she was getting eaten by a giant plant monster at the end of Children of the Corn 3, and the camera was literally like right up her skirt when the tendrils were attacking
her. Okay, ouch.
And then last week's movie, she is first introduced topless and bloodied in a photograph, and then basically is forced into rough sex with James Spader for much of a movie that she sort of kind of seems into, but it's also kind of convenient writing. It seems like she's not really into it. So by comparison, this was a cut above in terms of, you know, what we've seen so far. I mean, she's not truly fully not objectified at all, but compared to the last two movies, which came out last year, 1995, 1996, because this is also 96, like, this is much, much better.
No, yeah, you made a compelling argument for that. Yeah.
And I think this is PG too, right? Like, there's a rating involved as well. So they try and slip in subliminal sexual suggestions along the way, I feel, here and there.
The cuckolding
art film.
But it's all
playful compared to, yeah, some hardcore stuff.
And so the other quick things about the extended edition is that there's a lot more scenes where Guy is flirting with Faye, who's played by Liv Tyler, and we also see a lot more scenes of Charlize falling out of love with Guy, even though, like, it seems like in this cut, like, after she leaves his apartment or whatever in the beginning, it seems like they're never in love. Like, it just seems like that's the end. Like, as soon as he joins the band, she's like, well, I'm done. It seems a little bit too much, and we'll get into this, but we see all these different ways of, like, her getting hit with the fire extinguisher spray and, like, her falling in love with this pretty dentist, which is weird because we know that she had no teeth when she was actually, like, a real-life child, so that's sort of strange, and, like, all these different things like that, so it feels a little unnecessary, but for the purposes of what we're doing, I'm glad that we got lots more Charlize. And there's also the bass player in this movie who does not have a name.
Which I didn't know this entire time.
Yeah, in the credits,
he's just
TB
player. TB player. The bass player.
I could have sworn they referred to him by name, but I was just calling him Ethan because it's played by Ethan Embry.
Well, he said that his name was Tobias. It's like TB, and he's like, he's such a Tobias, is what he said. He, in the middle of the movie...
Oh, during the montage on the road, right?
Right, and he, like, is in love with one of the women in the Chantralines, and so in the theatrical version, it sort of seems like this unrequited love, but in this version, we see that he actually, like, they actually do the dirty corn together, which, Nico, by the way, that is our slang for having sex, because that is sort of what happened in the first horror movie. You've missed a lot in two episodes.
Everybody has. I mean, it's not on Nico, it's just, we're sorry, but in two episodes, we didn't realize how much mythology in Watch the Throne would actually materialize.
Yep. And then the only other difference, the major difference, is that at the end of the movie, instead of becoming a studio drummer, as per the suggestion of his jazz icon played by Bill Cobbs, who's back for another movie we're doing, Mike, which I'd love to see Bill Cobbs here, he becomes a radio DJ, which I don't know if that's a step up or a step down, or just seems strange and different.
Yeah, Clint Howard offers him the job too, which was... Again, I don't remember him. I know he was in one scene of the original, but they bring him back for the extended cut.
Hashtag step down.
I think so, right? Because, like, you can be, like, doing what you love and performing jazz music, even if you're not going to become famous. Or you can just, like, talk about it on air?
But he'll get to meet his idols as they pass through town and interview them. I mean, what else is weird is that that's not even where he really ends up, because you get those sort of American Graffiti type afterwards, right? And, like, he moves to Washington State and opens a conservatory? Like, what? Like, that is super specific. Like, I feel like everybody's afterward is, like, pretty specific.
This cut of this movie was sort of like, they bang and then happy ending, they bang and then happy ending, they bang and then happy ending. Like, this was the Everybody Bangs edition, and also the Everybody Has a Happy Ending edition. It was too long by 30 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely way too long. Like, I will concede to that. There's a happy medium here somewhere. Maybe, like, 2 hours, an hour 50, somewhere around there. My favorite new stuff is before they hit big. Like, I think all the newer stuff works a little better in that context. Afterwards, I just felt, I don't know, like, I just felt like I know the original movie so well. After they make it big, I started noticing, like, oh, this might not fit here, or this is out of place, or this is kind of jarring now. I think the momentum may have been broken up a little too much with a little too much extra footage towards the second half of this, but I actually quite enjoyed most of it.
What I felt was weird, and I think it was just a product of how long it was that this time around, because I haven't seen a theatrical movie in a couple years, and I've never seen this. Did either of you see this version before, or is this the first time for all of us?
I think it has to be my first time, but, like, TBH, when I looked up what was some of the stuff that was at, let me rephrase that. I'm a giant man baby. When my husband went on Wikipedia for me and read me the differences, and I went, hold on, slow down, I have to put this in my notes. When that happened, he was like, this definitely wasn't in the film. And I'm like, are you sure? Because, like, I feel like I've seen that. And he's like, nope. And I'm like, how high did I watch this movie? Let me...
Yeah, I've never seen this either, and Joey, I think, like I was telling you when I was getting ready to watch the movie, like, I didn't even know this cut existed, and it's been around for 10 years. This was definitely the first time the last time I saw the original cut was very recently, like, within a year or two, like, it was on, and I was like, I'm gonna sit down and watch this, because it's, like, a nice, quick, breezy, fun movie that puts you in a good mood.
I have the Blu-ray, but it was tucked away, because I have all my movies in boxes right now, and, like, the Blu-ray comes with both versions, so if it was out and I was looking, I would have known about it, but when you were like, hey, there's two versions. Like, I was just ready to watch it on Stars Play, where it is right now, or Amazon or something. Like, I was just ready to watch the one version, but then when you're like, there's an extra 40 minutes and, like, it's mostly Charlize, I was like, oh, then this is what we have to do. But what was weird for me was that I think it was just because it was right around that hour 40 mark, right when they're about to play on national TV, I kind of hit a wall where I was like, oh, this feels like it's dragging now. Like, it feels like at that point you're just like, oh, there's a lot. Like, I feel like we're sort of like, I want to get to where I know we're going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I was feeling too. Like, I feel like after they hit it big, the movie really just has to keep running, and it doesn't really have time to spread itself out anymore. And, like, a lot of the footage is extended takes. Like, when they're jamming in the garage for the first time with Guy, they go over the song a lot longer, and then they talk about covering another song at one point. And I think that works best, but you're right. I just think it breaks up the momentum too much in the second half, and, like, this movie just needs to end, like, at a certain point, and, you know, they gotta get on TV. There's, like, too much happens after their TV appearance, I feel. They need to really truncate that stuff. That, for me, is just where it worked the least.
I think part of the problem for me was I kind of resented watching this movie for this podcast. I am so happy to be here, and I was so happy to watch this movie, but when she's not in the last hour of the film,
yeah,
I'm, like, bitter about it.
Oh, yeah, we've had problems before with Cage Club and Keanu Club where we've sat through, like, an hour and a half for about 2 or 3 minutes of Cage or something, or Keanu, yep. And so this was nothing compared to that, but I could see from your perspective, like, right, there's nothing to really talk about for the last hour of this movie regarding why we're here, the actor we're here for. But we do get, like, those hilarious scenes of their date when she's, like, at the golfing range, the driving yep. range and stuff, mm-hmm. and putting up wallpaper in his office.
Oh, I'm just double checking. So he's got money too. Oh, okay. He's got money too. So it is a cuckolding art film. Okay.
Well, what's weird is she's like, I gotta go to the dentist and get a crown. It's gonna take all day. And I know this was in the 60s, but that takes like an hour. Guy should be on to the fact that she doesn't want to be around him that much, that his song is on the radio and she could care less. And he seems a little, I don't know, like he's not really, not that he's not with it, but like he's not fully aware of what's going on. I feel like he has trouble reading social cues from time to time.
So there's the one scene that I want to talk about where it's what Nico referenced earlier. There's one part where we actually see her getting dental work done. Dr. Collins has his fingers all in her mouth and everything like that. The Wonders song, That Thing You Do, comes on the radio, and it seems like she kind of gets excited, because this is the time where it's being broadcast, I think, from like Ohio or Pittsburgh or something, right?
National now.
Yeah, it's on the really, really powerful radio station, as opposed to just like a local Erie, Pennsylvania station. It seems like she gets excited, and I wonder if that was like a, oh no, did I make the wrong choice? Because I'm here, my husband or my soon-to-be husband or whatever, you know. We don't, I mean, they might have gotten married in the span of this movie. Who knows? Like, things moved quickly back then. But my boyfriend or my husband or whatever is here doing work on my teeth, and this guy that I used to be with is now becoming famous and potentially also rich. Did you guys get that sense that maybe her character was like, oh no, like, I'm not sure, because she's trying to point to the radio and he's just not getting it. He's like, oh, like you hurt, like here's some more Novocaine or whatever.
Yeah, I thought that was only the second time she emoted in the entire film. Like, I think her character was just meant to be like that girl, You know what I mean? Like, that person that, that's, oh man, I'm about to get so gay on the wrong podcast here, but...
Let it out.
The chick that Sandy's trying to be at the end of Grease, like, she just is that girl. Tell me about it, stud. The only times she emotes in the entire thing are at I Am Spartacus, and this moment... in the chair.
The first I Am Spartacus, because he says it a couple more times, and she's like,
and she's not like, I get it, you're Spartacus, Tony Curtis, whatever. It's ridiculous.
What's also sort of, like, dehumanizing a little bit, because you said, like, she has to be that girl, is that at the very, very end of the movie, when Guy and Liv Tyler are maybe sort of kind of getting together, she's like, were you in love and Erie with that girl, Tina? Like, she even says, like, that girl, Tina. She's just a thing. I think it's more of a character, like, you're right, Mike, that it's, that Tom Hanks was able to create something there, but it still feels like she's sort of like this statuesque beauty, what he's supposed to want.
Yes.
And the fact that, like, if he stays in Erie, like, that's, like, the best version of his future. But because he wants more out of life than just running an appliance store or maybe putting his name on the appliance store, he realizes that, like, she's just a pretty girl in a small town, but he could have the world if he becomes a famous musician.
Yeah, and it's also, like, she's very superficial, too. Like, she might look like the trophy wife,
but
deep down, like, she's not a very nice person, or at least not to Guy. They just don't share the same interests. And when she's in that chair and... she recognizes that song. I felt like she thought she might have made a mistake, but ultimately, that's not what she's into. She doesn't want to date a musician, or else she would have been with Guy from the start. There's another scene earlier where he sends her all these photographs of himself on the road, and I got the sense then that she was going to, like, show up somewhere in California in a deleted scene looking to get him back, but catch him with Liv Tyler. It's weird. There's a lot of, like, Betty and Veronica stuff going on with her and Liv Tyler in the opening, and I think that is just sort of a shorthand because it's very familiar imagery, you know, there's like the quote-unquote...
the blonde,
like,
and the brunette.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And clearly Faye is just much more Guy's type. Like, they relate, like, instantly when he's like, I dinged your bumper, and they flirt, like, right in front of her boyfriend and don't seem uncomfortable about any of it. Like, I got the sense that they belong together.
So that scene, and Nico, you can confirm for us, that scene where they, like, he bumps it and the, or bumps the bumper, taps the bumper, and then says it to her, that's not in the theatrical version, I don't think, or at least that's not, like, or it's extended, at least in this one, right?
It's either extended or not in the theatrical, because, like, I said, there's a whole bunch of this that I'm like, no, I've seen this before, but I'm told no, and so I'm like, maybe this is, like, a scene that's really just, like, a quick 2-second shot in the other, I don't know.
Well, I feel like there's that sense of deja vu, maybe, because it feels like you've seen it, because you don't need to see it. Like, you know, you sort of get the sense just from how they interact, like, with the bologna sandwich or whatever, like, they're cute together. Like, they're supposed to be together. It's not supposed to be her and the guitarist. Like, it's supposed to be them. You don't need to see him being like, oh, I'll buy you breakfast. Like, I'm so sorry. Because, like, you just sort of assume that he does nice things for her, I think. Again, I like that there's, like, because that is a nice moment. It feels good, but it also feels like we don't need to see that. And I understand why, if they wanted to trim a minute out to cut it down for theaters, like, that's what something you could take out.
Yeah, and I picked up on that in the original cut too. First time, like, watching this, I definitely thought that the two of those guys were gonna get together at the end of the movie, that they belong together. So I feel like you're right, like, it's just extra exposition. You know, if you've seen the movie before and you want to explore more of this love story, like, it's there, the material was there for you, so, like, let's put it out there. We only need one or two of them, though. Like, I feel like we could either take the bumper ding or the bologna sandwich thing, but we don't need, like, three or four of these, like, re-meet cute moments throughout the movie where they're constantly, like, giggling with each other, because one's enough.
Yeah, leftovers aren't so good the third time.
So I don't know if you guys noticed this time around, but in the director's cut, I definitely got the sense that Guy was a lot older than the rest of the band. I mean, much more so than in the theatrical. Like, they call him old guy or thanks mister and things, and he calls them, like, yes, kids. Like, he refers to them as kids often. Did either of you guys pick up on that?
100%. There's that scene where he says that he served in the military, which makes him feel a lot older than the other guys. And, you know, as a kid, you know, and I hate that I understand hindsight goggles are a real thing now in hindsight. Damn it, hindsight goggles are like a double-edged sword. But, like... you know, sometimes my teenage students say stuff to me like, I don't know stuff from before the year I was born. And I'm like, when were you born? And they say, 2000. And I'm like, shut up. I guess when I used to watch this movie as a kid, I was sort of like, oh, they're all old. Ha 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 ha. But like now I'm like, nah, there's a serious there's like a visible difference. Steve Zahn has been playing 42 pretending he's 25 his entire career. But the rest of them, you can sort of see there's a clear delineation in ages.
I didn't really think about him being older in the movie, although I guess the bass player, Ethan Embry, is going off to military, so I guess he's sort of like maybe 5 years younger, so it's probably Guy is probably like 23 and everybody else is probably 18-ish. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
One thing that I read, this is like we said before, this was the first movie that Tom Hanks directed, but because he had been an actor, there was this oral history that I sent you guys. I only read the beginning of, because it's not written like an oral history. It's written like a blog post or like a online story. And I just want to read straight quotes. Like I don't want filler text in between the quotes. But anyway, what they were saying, it was basically really like a young crew of actors, you know, had been acting before, but like they're all like in their teens or early 20s or whatever, you know, the people in the band and Liv Tyler. Even though this was his first movie, he had been an actor for so long that he knew exactly how to talk to them and made them feel comfortable. So it is interesting that like not only are they young kids in the movie sort of experiencing this for the first time and like not necessarily like their first job or whatever, but like in real life, they're all also sort of experiencing a lot of this for the first time and like being on a set with arguably the hottest actor in Hollywood at the time, coming off a year or two after Forrest Gump. Like, Tom Hanks is the biggest star in the world at this time, and he's treating them like equals and making them feel comfortable, and like, it's pretty cool, I think.
It is kind of an interesting parallel there, too, as far as the character he's playing in the movie that's sort of shepherding this band into success also. Like, he's this father figure in a way, I suppose, but he's looking after the kids, like, in real life on the set, like these young actors, and then in the movie, he's taking care of the band and the characters that they're playing. So it's kind of interesting.
And he definitely had a really good time and like made it a family thing, because I don't know if anybody else spotted the guest appearance from a young Colin Hanks.
Yes.
And his daughter is in this movie apparently somewhere too.
Oh, he's got a daughter. That's terrific.
I had no clue.
As of 2016, it was the only film to date to feature Tom Hanks, Rita Wilson, Colin Hanks, and daughter Elizabeth Hanks. So they're all in here. It's a family affair, getting everybody involved on set.
And did you guys spot Bryan Cranston?
Yeah.
Because there's a Hanks connection with him.
Yeah.
He's in his next movie, but he played Buzz Aldrin in From the Earth to the Moon, which was produced by Hanks. And
yep.
He plays an astronaut here in this movie. So it's sort of like a shout out to like, hey, I'm doing this other thing for you where I'm playing an astronaut.
There's a long list of cameos on the wiki page.
Paul Feig.
Dude, what was that about?
Right?
I couldn't believe it. He had freaking energy in this movie. I was like, do more acting, less directing.
There's also Mike, Golden Peach Award winner Chris Isaac.
Yeah.
In this
what?
Movie.
I missed them.
No, Chris
he's
Isaac.
The guy who records their
in the church.
He
yeah.
records their songs.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I knew that dude looked so familiar. I was like, who is this guy? Why is his young, hip uncle, like, recording church music? What is up with that?
Yeah, so, Nico, a little bit of background for you. So, Wicked Game, obviously everybody knows Wicked Game, was in three different Nicolas Cage movies. And so when we did the Cage Club Awards at the end, that was nominated for Best Song, and we picked it to win Best Song because it was used in three different movies. So when he popped up here, I was like, oh, like, it's cool. Like, you know, this is the beginning of a new journey for me and Mike, and here he is, an old favorite. Although, for the first time, I think, Mike, in any of our movies, in front of the camera instead of just on the soundtrack.
Oh, is that right? I thought he popped up in front of something. We had a country western guy in Little Buddha, right? Or, I mean, we've had bad musician actors on.
Well, we had a whole rap artist category in Cage Club.
Yeah, but they're primarily good, I felt. Like, those guys were good actors, as opposed to, like, the country western stars who come on.
But here's the thing about Chris Isaac. Chris Isaac is famous for two songs and also being Chris Isaac. He's not, like, tremendously famous for his music. It's like Harry Connick Jr. They look vaguely similar. They both are kind of like, man, the 50s were a cool time. They're both famous for being personalities, but not much else. It's, you know, Chris Isaac in this is like Chris Isaac in Twin Peaks. It's just like, why?
Yeah, he's kind of a wooden board, I suppose. But I guess that's what I'm getting. I mean, I didn't even pick up on him, so there you go, right? He didn't leave an impression on me.
One thing, going back just a second to Tom Hanks and sort of, you know, his interactions with everybody on set, I don't know how it would have worked. I wish that we got a scene between Tom Hanks and Charlize.
Oh, good
I don't call. Know how that would have happened. One little side thing is that apparently she was the first actor to audition for this movie and was also the first actor that he cast in this movie.
She's got a total look from the 60s. Like, she stepped right out of Peggy Sue Got Married. Mm-hmm. Like, I was thinking of that movie a lot watching this movie.
the only way that I can see this happening is if, Mike, if your idea of, like, she shows up to California to find them on tour, and Tom Hanks pulls her aside and, like, can sense the type of person she is, like this, you know, gold digger or this somebody who's just after money and fame and success or whatever, and he pulls her aside and is just like, not like you're not welcome here, but like, I know what you're after. Think very carefully about your actions. Like, I would love a scene between the two of them. Like, however it would have played out, I don't think it would have gone well for her, because he seems like supremely confident in all things, which I understand when you're writing a movie, like, you're gonna give yourself a good character. Like, that's totally cool. Like, I wish that they had a scene together. I don't know how it would have happened. Maybe in the future, perhaps.
Yeah, I feel like it's the one thing this movie's missing.
Well, I think nobody's addressing the bigger thing in the room. I love that you were both like, yeah, she starts seeing this dentist, then everything's really cool. Because I was sort of like, if they're dating, he's doing an unbearable amount of dental work on her. And yes. Even if it's not unethical, I'm sort of afraid he's like convinced her that she has dead mouth's disease. And he No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that that's the part of this movie that didn't make it into this director's cut. I'm pretty sure there was no amount of footage that was left on the floor that featured our wonderful Miss Theron that did not get used in this director's cut. If there was a scene where she was like, I got the results back, it's definitely tooth cancer, then I am sure it would have been in that thing that Charlize Theron does in this art film about cuckolding that has nothing to do with the Oneaters.
Well, so Nico, early on I mentioned this, but in real life, when she was a child growing up in South Africa, Charlize had jaundice, and she took so many antibiotics that all of her teeth rotted out. So she has this weird history of dental work, and so maybe she does have dead mouth's disease. Dead mouth's disease sounds like dead mouse disease, which is a whole other thing. That's a whole other ball of wax there.
Dead mouse, the dead DJ mouse, guy?
Dead Now 5.
That's actually going to be on the next Now, Dead Now 5. Absolutely.
But maybe her character, she took a page out of her real life and was like, oh, I'm always at the dentist because I know what it's like to need lots of dental work. This makes sense to me.
I have a theory, guys. Okay. And I haven't had a wacky theory for a while.
I think
this might be. I feel like her audition was Hank saying, tell me something about yourself. And she tells this story about how she grew up and she had jaundice and all this stuff and her teeth rotted out and she, you know, all this and that. And he goes, oh my God, I'm going to work that into the movie somehow. That's going to be like a character trait. Your character goes to the dentist all the time because she has a teeth problem. And you know what? Like, hey, I like you so much. We're gonna do this whole B story that's not even going to make it into the final cut. Because why are they showing this if she never shows back up? It's so misleading.
Thank you.
It's driving me crazy.
Cuckolding art film. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. With all the negative shit that came out about my precious Joss Whedon, because, you know, obviously I'm a young gay man. I grew up on Buffy. It was my everything. My whole world is comic books. So clearly I connect with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But, like, I'm so scared that we're going to find out when Rita has to leave Tom that he's got this weird mouth fetish. And Charlize was just his first tooth girl.
Ooh.
Now he's going to start really pushing it. His next movie is going to be called The Orthodontist. And it's going to be, you know what I mean? Like, this is what I'm afraid of.
Wait. His other movie's Larry Crown. Crown Tooth.
Oh. Fuck.
Nico.
Oh, fuck.
Nico, you're onto something.
I am, guys.
If only Larry Crown was a dentist that he played, that would have been amazing.
We need to get James Stewart on this because this is the next Den of Lies. This is the Den of Thieves. I'm forgetting my Pulitzer Prize books about Wall Street. But anyway, it's that.
What I really liked about Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, I looked up when they were married. They were married in 1988, so they've been married for almost a decade by this point.
They met on the set of Volunteers, right?
I think so.
That's a great movie.
They've been bosom buddies for so long.
When Guy meets her at the Blue Spot and then ditches her to talk to Bill Cobbs, she drives a very drunk Guy back to the hotel, basically passes him off to Tom Hanks. She's just like, you know, one more drink and like I would have been sleeping with this guy. And I like that there's like that wink there that like these are two unconnected people in the movie, married in real life. Here you go. Here's your boy back. Like he was almost my boy for the evening, but I like that weird little thing. I hope that they don't get divorced in real life because I mean they've been married for almost 30 years by this point.
I think she's his second wife.
She
already,
is his second wife. His first wife is also in this movie somewhere.
What? It is a family affair.
I definitely gay read something there. Like, I mean, I just had to bring the faggotry about it. But I think the thing that happened was, once we knew that Tom Hanks' character was gay with Howie Long, that lucky son of a bitch, and then he meets this woman that I immediately thought was a prostitute.
Yeah, I got the sense that she would call on the side, if you know.
Yeah, and I kind of thought maybe, like, they know each other from the bathhouse.
Well, I pick up on that now, too, when she's like, I hand him off to you. He doesn't like women. He likes you, because obviously he didn't fall for me, Rita Wilson, who looks amazing in this. So, like she knows the Hanks character is gay. Mm.
There was a very kind of, like, there was very, your hag takes care of you. You know what I mean? And, like, as somebody whose hags have been so good to me over the years, I don't know any gay man who would be anything without his wonderful women. Yeah, she strikes me as, like, that's so weird. I'm going to write a movie and make myself gay and make my wife my prostitute hag.
Ooh, I like that a lot. Well,
that's the thing. It's like, there's all these interesting threads, but they're not necessary for the core story. You know, the story about the Oneaters hitting it, coming together, being a one-hit wonder. I mean, all this extra footage has nothing really to do with that very much, you know, like all the extra character moments. I'd say.
I want to take a step back for a second, Mike, to your crazy theory. And I like that your crazy theory about Charlize's audition, which is Tell Me a Story, is basically the audition scene from La La Land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think that's where they got it in La La Land. Like, that's a very popular thing I feel like you hear in an audition.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I just like that this movie, like, there's not that many movies about jazz.
I was just gonna bring it up, how Hank saves jazz first.
Yep, just as opposed to, you know, a white Canadian boy saving jazz in La La Land.
Oh, I love how many white people save jazz.
But La La Land coming to the Cage Club Podcast Network on Boyfriend Material next Thursday. But did you remember from La La Land, Tom Everett Scott plays Emma Stone's eventual husband in that movie?
That was Tom Everett Scott?
Yeah, because Damien Chazelle loved this movie so much growing up that he wanted to cast him in that movie, and Tom Everett Scott was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. He's like, the guy who did Whiplash? Yes, I want to be in this part. Yes.
The last thing I saw Tom Everett Scott in was he's the new dad. I think he actually plays Steve Zahn as the dad in Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Huh. So how weird is that?
Steve Zahn was also the best man at his wedding. So there's a little bit of a connection there, too. So, yeah. This movie opened a lot of doors for a lot of people.
I actually was struck by what a great Broadway musical this show would make.
Wow.
A lot of the changes that you would have to make to it to improve it would fix a lot of the plot problems. You'd have to have a smaller cast. There'd need to be more focus on the other stars in the Playtone galaxy. And it would make a great Broadway musical. If nobody wants to adapt it, you can just call me. I'll do it. It's fine.
Yeah, because I was surprised this time around to learn that there is other music in this aside from that thing you do, the song. You know, the first couple times watching it, it's hard to think of anything else for a couple days except for that song, because it just gets drilled into your mind so much. But there's a lot of other good music by the other artists that are on the Playtone label.
Even the other songs by the Wonders.
Yeah, that's true, too. They have a couple tunes.
The song, That Thing You Do, was written by the bassist for the Fountains of Wayne, shout out to New Jersey, Adam Schlesinger.
What up?
But the song that opens the movie, Loving You Lots and Lots, was written by Tom Hanks as sort of like a parody of like the songs of that time. But that's also a super catchy song too. Like, I was reading that like the full version of That Thing You Do is only played twice in this movie, but it's played in some form 11 times in this movie. Like, it's wallpaper throughout this thing, and like, it's just such a good song. Like, every time it comes on, I've seen the scene where it plays on the radio for the first time more than anything else in this movie, and I still get chills when it happens, because like, Liv Tyler's overwhelming joy is just wonderful. They're all so excited to hear it, and it's like, you know it's gonna happen, you know this is like the band's rise and then fall, and you know the plot points, but like, every time it plays, it's just such a good, fun, catchy song. It's like, oh, I love this.
Yeah, I was actually struck at how moved I was this time watching that scene where it first comes on the radio. Like, I really got chills this time. I was like, damn, this is really well done. Everybody is really selling it. And this sort of evolution of the scene where one person hears it, runs into the other person on the street, and they go into the store and turn on all the radios, and then the rest of the band shows up. They're doing like a conga line or something around the whole store or something. The energy is there, and Hanks's directing skills are on fire in that scene for sure.
Picking Liv Tyler was also a really smart move about in a movie about musicians. Even before she knew her father was Steven Tyler, growing up, she thought her dad was Todd Rundgren.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Her mom was like a very, like, well-known, like, you know, like, muse chick in that time.
Sort of like the from almost famous Penny Lane type.
Yeah. Almost, like. Yeah. And so she was such a great person to associate with this because Liv Tyler, we already associated her with Steven Tyler. She had just done all those music videos for Aerosmith where her father limitlessly sexualized her. Now she's showing us her joy. Oh, and Empire Records was either right before or right after this. Her career, we associate her with music, and we see her that way. Putting her in these scenes almost added a sense of genuineness. You know what I mean?
Like, she's lived this in real life, and, like, this is how people would react.
Yeah, it'd be like putting Andrew Dice Clay in a TV show about a washed-up comedian who doesn't know when to quit.
Yeah. Dice.
You know what other scene I like, though, real quick? Like, something else that really played really well again for me this time is when they're at the talent show and they start playing it for the first time and Guy speeds up the song without telling anybody.
Yep.
That's a really great sequence and technically very tough because at the start of the song everybody's playing catch up and then by the end they're like perfectly in sync and everybody's got it down and into it. So I really like that again this time.
And there's actually like technical ways to do that. And funny enough, this is the only time in history anyone's ever going to have a reason to bring up Harry Connick Jr. twice in the same podcast. But if you go on YouTube and you look up Harry Connick Jr. fixes the tempo, you'll catch this video of Harry Connick Jr. The audience starts clapping on the wrong beat to one of his very constantly similar jazz songs. And he plays like a little magical 5/4 measure or something, like some obscure, it doesn't need to exist, measure. He plays it once or twice, and it automatically puts the audience back on the right beat.
Interesting. Wow. It's like musical hypnosis or something.
Yeah, there's techniques you can use. So, like, knowing the kind of love that Tom Hanks had for this film, I wouldn't be surprised if they did engage some sort of, like, hey, let's make sure this is 100% right 100% of the time.
Speaking of that talent show, do either of you recognize, what is it? I couldn't find them online. Who is their fan? What has he been in?
Oh, he's been in so much. Yeah, I don't know this guy, but he pops up everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially in the 90s.
Because he was so good in this movie. He's basically the anti-Charlize early on in their career. Steve Zahn even says at one point, he's like, hey, isn't that our fan? Like, our one single fan? Which, as an up-and-coming baby podcast network, I basically know a lot of the people who, like, listen to us. You know, like, if people tweet at us or write on our Facebook wall or whatever, like, I know these people because there's not that many of them. So I sort of sympathize. We're just waiting for our that thing you do, our breakout to a national audience. I really liked him. He was so good in this. He just keeps popping up, which is, it's just so funny. That he was, I loved him in this.
That's actually such a really human thing, and thank you for saying it. And as you know, one creator to another, when we first started with the comic and people would come up to us and they'd be like, oh, I've heard of you. And we'd be like, no, you haven't. They would be like, no, I've heard of Kid Riot. And I would be like, that's not possible. The only people that have heard of Kid Riot live in my house. So you can't possibly have heard of Kid Riot. And, like, you know, I've had to get better about it because there's nothing more off-putting when, like, somebody comes up to your table and they're like, oh my God, I've been waiting to check this out. And I'm like, are you sure? That's a hard sell to make. So that's another thing that they captured really genuinely, and that's really interesting that they captured it so genuinely, especially Tom Hanks. And not that I'm saying that famous people aren't capable of being just like us, but famous people, you know, it's how much can a banana cost from Arrested Development?
Well, it's like when George W. Bush went to the supermarket and didn't know that you scanned your items. I mean, this is going way back, but since we're in, the movie came out in the 90s.
Yeah.
I remember when the first George Bush was president. It's like, wow, it's technology. I mean, people are just out of it, I guess, or just it's not on their plane of existence.
Tom Hanks, this guy who's been famous for acting since at least the early 80s, if not earlier, manages to recreate this sense of outsidership, this sense of I can't believe it's finally happening to me, that I can't believe that he genuinely remembers to that sort of extent. It's like, I love him and I think George Clooney is going to help save us all or whatever. But when he was like, he gave that like tirade recently where he was like, don't say that I'm the millionaire guy with the golden shoes. Fuck you. I cleaned bathrooms and I mopped up vomit after comedians at clubs and I did this and I did that. And I want to be like, but you were on ER in 1994 and it's 2017 and baby girl, it's time to let go of the past. There is something so powerful about how truly Tom Hanks did get that over and over again.
Absolutely. It frustrates me a little bit that, like, we all enjoy this movie so much that, like, I don't know why he didn't do more.
Why he didn't direct more movies?
Why he didn't write or direct more movies, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess you're busy acting, and you don't, like...
Yeah, he's a megastar. I feel like this was, like, the studio saying, look, thanks for Forrest Gump, you could do anything you want next. And he's like, well, come to think of it, I've always wanted to direct, like, I might be good at that. And they're like, all right, let's give him a shot. But it is kind of surprising that it was so well-received, they didn't ask him to direct something else, you know? Like, I could understand him being like, I don't really have anything on my mind or a project to do or anything, but it is kind of weird that the studio wasn't like, hey, you got another thing you do in you? You got, like, a sequel? You got, like, where's the band now? Like, 20 years later, what can we do with them? Or anything, really.
Two things. Number one, now I need a sequel to That Thing You Do, but I need it to be kind of a la The New Odd Couple, where they're trying to capture a very different kind of market. And it's called, like, That Groove You Jam. And it's like a 1970s funk version of it. And it's directed by Nick Cannon, and it's like a surprise breakout hit, and it wins tons of awards. And everybody's like, holy shit, that's Mr. Mariah Carey up there, because they're back together now. Everybody should know that. You should all keep abreast of Mariah Carey the way I do.
I mean, it is strange, though, because, like, Hanks's next movie that he directs, Crown Thing, it's like the most bizarre. So it's like a middle-aged guy going back to college, and he's also like a short-order cook.
Oh,
and
yeah!
He falls in love with his teacher, who's Julia Roberts, and wins over the rest of his class, which includes Mr. Robot, the guy from Mr. Robot. So, like, it's just so different than this. Like, it's just like a world apart from what he's dealing with here. This feels more like nostalgia, recapturing some of his childhood. Like, this is Hanks growing up, and I don't know what the new movie was supposed to be.
I only vaguely remembered it when you said, middle-aged guy, goes back to school. And I was like, wait, Larry Crown. No, that's Patch Adams. Larry Crown. No, that's Michael. Larry Crown. Which white guy movie was that? Oh! As soon as you said Julia Roberts and back in school, I was like, it's the movie about the actor that's not popular anymore who works in a school. It's the one with Matt Damon. No, that's Good Will Hunting. Oh! It's the one with Julia Roberts. Right. This is before they started realizing that if you throw in a minority, you can make the same movie again.
Speaking of making the same movie again, we're going to get to the recast game shortly. Do we have any other last thoughts about That Thing You Do, the extended version, the Charlize cut, if you will? I have some little odds and ends bits of trivia and stuff. It's the Charlize cut. But Nico, yeah. any other last thoughts before we get to the recast game? Any other notes that you want to mention? Any other facts that you want to drop? Any other opinions you want to share about why this is the inferior version to the theatrical cut?
Like I've said a few times now, my husband is he's my rock. He's my world. He's my Dr. Quinn medicine woman. I run everything I say and do by him first. I really did say to him, all right, Kevo, so, because, you know, we made the ha 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 cuck joke, ha ha ha, and, you know, oh, all these scenes are longer. Oh, look, it's really progressive that there's a gay subplot and there's an interracial romance subplot. At the end of the day, I still really resented watching this for Charlize Theron, and I can say why. So I'm a huge Buffy fan, as I already mentioned with the Joss Whedon thing, Rubber Band. Mm-hmm. If you're a big Buffy fan, you probably have had the DVDs at some point. Spike, like my least favorite character, is introduced in season 2, where he's recurring. He's in one episode of season 3. He is recurring in season 4. Then he's a regular in 5, 6, 7. I bring this up because I said he's in one episode of season 3, right? Yeah, he has his own disc of the DVD set.
Oh.
And it's sort of like, he only got a disc of the DVD set because he had just become a regular on the show due to fan popularity in real time. So they gave him one of the disc faces of the third season set when he appears in one episode. Now, this might seem like a silly thing that I'm harping on, but Giles is a regular throughout the first 5 seasons and at least in half or so of each season, 6 and 7. And he doesn't get a disc till season 7. And, oh, 4? He has a disc in season 4 and season 7. I have to be completely honest. My husband is right behind me and he's correcting me as I'm talking.
He's like the second character introduced in the first episode of that show. It's like Buffy meet the librarian.
Yeah. Everything about Charlize Theron, this really is That Thing You Do, you know, Theron Recall. It's just like, it's bizarre to me that Tom Hanks would go back and be like, oh, she made that movie, that monster movie where she, oh, I'm so excited, right? I'm so excited because I do it all the time. And I found a way to bring up BT on this show. BT actually scored both Fast and the Furious and Monster. He's a musician. I work into every episode of Now and Again.
I'm well aware of your BT incorporations.
Yeah. And I got to say there's a Charlize one and there's a Fast and the Furious one.
bam, bam, motherfuckers, bam, knocking them down.
Well, because, yeah, because the extended version of this movie was released in 2006, so she already, like, she was already on her way to stardom, I think, when, like, you could tell that she was something.
Yeah, she was, like, monstery.
2000 is sort of a turning point that she wins an Oscar in 2003, and they're like, oh, yeah, we've got another 40 minutes in that movie where it's, like, all about her. Like, let's go put it out and, like, make some more money. So, like, I totally see why you could view this as a cash grab. The next time I watch this movie, I'm going to rewatch the theatrical version. And then maybe I'll mix it up after that. But I just want to see. I feel like the theatrical version just sort of works better. But for what we did here, I'm glad that we saw everything that she had to offer.
Yeah, I agree. I'm baffled as to why there's so much extra footage of her. But I'm glad that I saw it because it made this episode better because there's much more of her in this cut. I will probably watch the theatrical cut again next also. I don't know that I'll rewatch this cut, you know, when I want to watch this movie. I think if there's like a moment or something that I feel like I want to see, I'll just skip to it or something. The theatrical cut is the main cut I think everyone should watch. This is just sort of like this weird curiosity. But I will say this, as far as director's cuts go, it's not just like an extra 5 or 6 minutes. Like, this is a full-on
50%
not entirely different, but like it's got a whole different feel to it, this movie, you know. It still feels fun, it's still snappy and stuff, but maybe just not as fast and not as quick, but
or not as furious.
There you go.
So some other quick little trivia tidbits before we get into the recast game. Steve Zahn is staying in room 237 at the hotel, which I was like, is that a Shining reference? Maybe. Bryan Cranston is playing an astronaut in this movie, but Tom Hanks' character is Mr. White, and so obviously Bryan Cranston now is probably best known for playing Walter White, Mr. White, on Breaking Bad, so I thought that was a little bit of a weird coincidence.
You mean the dad from Malcolm in the Middle?
Yes, the dad from Malcolm in the Middle, after he has a midlife crisis and goes and starts another family and then starts selling meth. Yes, that same guy.
I've never heard of this. I'll have to look out for that show.
Oh, he was in Power Rangers, Nico, one of the few movies.
I know, I did see that. I saw that for sure. No, that's actually fun Power Rangers tidbit, because now you've unleashed the beast. So fun Power Rangers tidbit, Billy Cranston is named after Bryan Cranston because Bryan Cranston was in one of the bad guy suits in an episode, and the producers really liked, what is it, honey?
Just a voice actor.
Oh, just a voice actor, but the producers really liked him. My husband, seriously, just corrects me, like on the spot. It's it makes me much more impressive than I am. Please don't edit him out. He is a gift.
I will leave him in there. The other last thing about the movie I want to say is that at the very end, Liv Tyler is sort of talking to Guy about Charlize, and she says, was she a good kisser? And he's just like, yeah. So now we have a defining characteristic of Charlize, at least this character, she is a good kisser. So we have that.
Oh, maybe that had something to do about her dental work that she needed to get done. Maybe,
she kissed so much that she wore her teeth away.
Or she just needed, you know, maybe like she had bad breath or something because of her dental work.
Maybe when she got cured of her dead mouth disease and they were like, well, what do you want? And she was like, well, if I'm going to get something, I want sexy good mouth. Because, like, I feel like now that they can, like, grow new penises and stuff, some guy's going to be like 12-incher. You know what I mean? And, like, ruin it for everybody else.
There's also a lot of parallels between the Wonders and the Beatles. Coming, you know, their name, the bad pun in their name, the type of song That Thing You Do Is, their performance sort of paralleling Ed Sullivan performance, replacing a drummer, losing a bass player, last-minute replacements.
Someone calls him Ringo.
The basis for Tom Hanks' character.
Yeah, the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, was also gay. There's just a bunch of different stuff. Oh, Liv Tyler getting mistaken for a female fan by police.
Oh, she's sort of the Yoko because she ends up breaking the band up.
A little bit, yeah. There's a lot of things like that, which is kind of cool, kind of funny.
Wait, does that make this movie Yoko Apologist?
Oh, maybe.
Maybe that's what Hanks is really trying to say.
Jeez,
maybe.
Double fantasy right there.
Mike, any last thoughts about That Thing You Do, or are we ready for the recast game?
Yeah, I think we should get on with it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Nico, you are new to the show. We have to explain this for every guest, but we had you, while watching this movie, pick out, if we're remaking the movie today, recast the four members of the band, Tom Hanks' character, Charlize's character, Liv Tyler's character, and also pick a new director if we were remaking the movie today. The only rules that we have are no whitewashing, so you can't turn a non-white character white, but in this movie, aside from the one Playtone band, pretty much everybody in this movie is white, and you can't turn any girls into guys, but you can turn guys into girls. And I really, really hope, with that said, I did not, but I hope one of you turned the Wonders into a girl rock band, which would be amazing.
Mine's not all female, but I definitely was like, this is not nearly intersectional or diverse enough. We're going to fix this. It's time to go small world.
All right, so let's start first with the Charlize Theron character, Tina. Nico, who did you cast for Charlize in today's remake?
The person I kind of find the most annoying, Ariana Grande.
Oh. Interesting direction.
I was like, you know what, just like go that. Full on blank vapid face, like that very what kind of face, just own it, own it, own it.
Mike, what about you?
I went in sort of a different direction. I went with Eliza Gonzalez, who played Darling in Baby Driver, and oh. I think you make her like a full on beatnik, just like totally not into this type of music and would rather be snapping her fingers at some poetry somewhere.
The person I cast, somebody we talked about on the last episode, I cast Jessica Roth from Happy Death Day, also one of the dress girls in La La Land, because I sort of saw her as Tree before Tree has the realization that she's a bad person. That, like, she's a beautiful blonde girl, smart and sort of gets it, but also just doesn't care. So I think that she could do it. Plus, I just, you know, like we said last week, have that movie on the brain, want to keep casting her and other people from that movie and things. So that's where I went for that.
I don't think we ever declare, like, a winner or anything like that, but good choices all around.
Well, thank you. I agree across the board. Nico, who did you cast as Liv Tyler?
Because she is my woman crush, Zendaya.
Oh, nice. Mike just cast Zendaya in something last week.
In The Children of the Corn 3, yeah.
I used to joke that I would watch Jodie Foster read the phone book, and then I joked that I would watch Meryl Streep critique Jodie Foster reading the phone book. I would watch a one-woman dramatic show of that performed by Zendaya brushing her teeth.
Oh, well, brushing your teeth.
Brushing your teeth.
Yep.
Wait a minute. Hungry Rabbit jumps.
There's a little bit of a dirty secret. Not a dirty secret, but like in this one Cage movie, January Jones brushes her teeth. And I didn't realize that was something that I wanted to see until I saw it. And I was like, oh, yeah. So Zendaya brushing teeth. Like, I'm okay with that too, I guess.
Hot. I have my own thing, but I'm smart enough not to say it on this show because Chris leaves every bad thing I say in, and I don't need people to know my teeth brushing moment.
Mike, what about Liv Tyler for you?
I kind of went with the same type, I suppose, but this person is really good in the one thing I've seen her in so far, and I look forward to her next movie coming out very soon, but I went with Daisy Ridley from Star Wars.
Oh, I love that.
And I'd let her keep the English accent too. Make her British, make that Beatles connection a little stronger.
Oh, hold on. Speaking of accents, this movie takes place in Pennsylvania. Did either of you pick up on a lot of like Canadian accents? It felt like a lot of people were sort of saying things with a Canadian affectation.
I couldn't tell because of all the maple syrup running out of their mouth.
I didn't, but I didn't pick up on any regional accent whatsoever. All right. It didn't sound like they were from this part of the world either.
No, Tom Hanks never sounds like he's from anywhere.
There was no jawning or any of that going on.
This a John, that's a John. So for my Liv Tyler, this is the part, Mike, that I wanted to do Allison Williams again because I think that she could do it, and I also just have a crush on her. But, Nico, we made a rule that we can't cast the same person twice in a row. We can reuse people, but just Mike and I can't do people two movies in a row. They're off filming the other movie. We can't use them again. We can't bother them again. So instead, I thought Liv Tyler, what I know her from recently is The Leftovers, and she's great on The Leftovers.
Yep, yeah.
So I went with Margaret Qualley, who plays Jill Garvey on that show, because she's also adorable. And I think that she could do this role, and she's also, you know, like a cute young brunette, and she would be sort of this girl to pine after and lust after and just sort of be around with the band.
I really love your movie studio tycoon rules. I think that's great. And yeah, I love that.
Thank you. So next, we'll do Tom Hanks, the Mr. White role.
Yeah, I went with my go-to. If I am that in love with Zendaya, I am equally in love with, in a very literal way, Stanley Tucci.
Oh, nice.
I would cast Stanley Tucci. I just love him so much. I would love to see his... So, okay, I love Cher, period, and I love Christina Aguilera, period, and I love Kristen Bell. Burlesque should have been a thing that I enjoyed instead of something done to me. Point of my story, though, he managed to still be good in that terrible film. Stanley Tucci can do anything, and I actually think because of his role in Burlesque, we have a good sense of how he would handle a role like this. And
sure.
I think he would do a really supportively emotive job. I think he could absolutely introduce these boys to the Hunger Games.
What I think, Mike, what's funny is that like two actors that Mike loves, Nico, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, are Stanley Tucci and Giovanni Ribisi. So
ooh,
I like
woof.
That Giovanni Ribisi was in this and that you recast Stanley Tucci in this? Because I feel like, in my brain, they're both similar, like, really good actors that are kind of underused or underrepresented or people don't love the way they should, and they're both now forever linked to that thing you do in one form or another.
And Tucci, no stranger to Cage Club. He was in As Good As It Gets, right? Not As Good As It Gets. He was in...
It Could Happen to You.
It Could Happen to You. So, yeah, and he's great in that.
I was really hoping you were going to say he played Mephisto in Ghost Rider, but... I know better, because I saw both of those, and they're so bad.
I think he plays Merlin in the new Transformers. I lasted literally 5 minutes before I got an aneurysm.
Mike, who is your Mr. White?
My choice for this is also my choice for director. I did a kind of a Hanks double thing. But I was going to go with Tom Everett Scott, because I thought he was like the Hanks of the movie.
I'm a little nervous. I think we might have a match. If we match, Uh-oh. It's going to be great, but let's see.
Okay, so my new Hanks, who is also the new director, is Jon Favreau.
Oh, it's not a match, but I like that.
Because I just think, like, Favreau is, he could be, he's got, like, the swingers snappiness of the cool, and then he can also do, like, a nice big studio comedy thing. Like, he's proven he could do that kind of stuff, too. I mean, he did Iron Man. I just think that he would bring the right sensibilities and get what this is all about.
I mean, you just said Mr. Zathura himself, so yes. And no, I love Jon Favreau. I thought he was mad hot as Pete on Friends. That's a great choice.
My Mr. White, I thought we had a match because it's the same first name, and it might just be because I'm watching Mad Men right now, but I think Jon Hamm could be a really good Mr. White. He's not my director. I think he could also probably direct this movie. That would be cool to see, but... Yeah, I think Jon Hamm would be a cool Mr. White, like this wise older man who's sort of a father figure to these kids and like that.
Absolutely.
So now, Nico, if you want to do the... Let's do the whole band as a unit, because I kind of tried to sort of put together... It doesn't really... It's not as meshy. It doesn't gel as well as I would like it to, but if you want to do your whole band in one fell swoop, who did you recast as the Wonders in each role?
Sure. For TB Player, I went with Marcus Schreibner, who plays Junior on Blackish.
Okay.
For Lenny Hayes, which is Steve Zahn, I recast him with Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, who
I love that.
My goddamned goddess. I recast Jimmy with Jussie Smollett, who is the young lead on Empire. He is a phenomenal singer. He's an incredible actor. He's a dynamic performer. He plays the good guy version of this character on Empire. I do not regret this for even 1 second. I cast Channing Tatum as Guy, and I don't take it back.
Well, I like that. So you turned a band of four white guys into a band of one white guy, right?
Yeah, that sounds like me. Yep, and that's what I did. Yep.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Mike, who you got for the Wonders?
All right, this was not easy. I don't know that they work as quite as well as a unit, but we'll see when I riff them off. So for Shades, I didn't realize that I went with Baby from Baby Driver, Anson Elgort, who I cast in our secret pilot, the episode after, so that doesn't count, so I can use him.
Yep.
So I'm going with Anson.
Shades as in Guy? As in the...
Yeah, okay. As in Guy, okay. As in the drummer, right. So like the lead, basically.
Yep.
For Leah, was it... Wait, for the...
So there's Jimmy. So Jimmy is dating Liv Tyler. There's okay. So, Lenny is okay. Steve Zahn, and there's the bassist.
Okay, so for Lenny... I had to go. I really wanted to go with Zac Efron just because he looked exactly like he had everything going, but I had to go in a different direction. I went with Kieran Culkin, basically because of his performance in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Sure.
Like, I just want him to do that kind of character here. I think he could pull that off. For the bassist, I went with Gerard Carmichael.
Okay.
But I would totally beef up his role, and then I'd have him sleep with a white girl.
Okay, I like that.
Halfway through the movie.
Ooh, sure. That's a really great twist on the... Yeah.
Switch that up a little bit. And then for the guitar player, I mean, I don't think the age is quite right, but I'm going with Adam Driver. Just because of the look. I don't know. I just want to see Adam Driver lead a band or try to, and watch it like sort of dissolve around him, and then him throw like a Sith fit at the end of the movie. So that's my band.
Love it.
I'm really disappointed in myself for keeping it four white dudes. I really got to diversify, because I think the trap that I fall into is, first off, who does it look like? And then sort of go from there. if I can't find something like that, or like, does it fit, does it work, whatever. For the bassist, I had to put this guy in the movie somewhere. I put Colin Hanks. Because he's got to be in there. I had him as, like, basically every role in this movie was Colin Hanks at one point. I'm like, I'm going to put him because, like, I don't want to give him preferential treatment. Like, you know, we're remaking that thing you do. I don't want to just take the son of the original director and give him the leading role. We're going to give him sort of a background part. So we're going to give Colin Hanks a bass player role.
Him as Tom Hanks' role could have been interesting casting, too.
Also that. Yeah. Again, like, these ages don't really line up because I think all of my guys are probably 30 or older. For Jimmy, the guitarist, who... There's also that speech that we didn't mention toward the end where Tom Hanks basically analyzes the entire band, and he basically says, like, I know that you're in love with Faye, with Liv Tyler, but he says that Jimmy is the talent, so I cast Joseph Gordon-Levitt in that role as the guitarist.
Oh, nice.
I'm a big fan. Yep, thumbs up.
And then the last two, for Guy, who Tom Hanks says is the smart one, and for Lenny, who he says is the fool, I kind of took a package deal that we talk about a lot on another podcast, and I did Guy, I turned it to Zac Efron, and nice. Lenny, I did Dave Franco.
Wait, so Guy is Zac Efron?
I want him to be the lead of the movie.
I actually had that originally, I'm not even kidding.
Interesting.
But what
because,
made...
okay. Also from Hairspray, we know that as Link Larkin, he can pull off this era, and we know that he can be that, like, kind of, you know, swinging, show-stopping 60s heartthrob guy. I would love to see him in the lead of this movie.
But isn't he too pretty?
Nice.
Isn't he too pretty, though? Like, isn't he too pretty to be Guy?
But you could work that into it, too. He could be not taken seriously because of his good looks and stuff. And
yeah,
and also the thing with Guy in this movie is that every woman's already in love with him, so it's not, it doesn't change anything. You know what I mean? Like,
that's why I went with Channing Tatum, who a lot of people think looks a little bit like Scrappy-Doo. I wanted to go with somebody who looked a little silly.
You could have actually gone with a cartoon character. I don't know.
I didn't clarify that. You can go cartoon characters.
Next time I'm going to cast Ziggy from the cartoon Ziggy.
So last thing, it's a new wrinkle this week. We're going to see how it plays out. Recasting the director. So we have this dream cast now. Who is directing this movie? Miko, who is your director for that thing you, or your jive, whatever. What was your original name for it? Like that?
That Groove You Jammed.
Yeah, for That Groove You Jammed, who's your director?
Well, I actually have to make a point additionally. It would need additional music to be remade, if you want my opinion. It is that thing you do too many times.
Okay.
I would need additional music by Rachel Bloom, since you're going to have her anyway. Use her. She's a goddamn genius. I would like my director to be Aziz Ansari. If for no other reason, a Master of None-esque take on this movie with a super diverse cast still set in the same era would really capture the God, I'm so broken at this point, but I find it really hard to root for four pretty white boys. Like, sorry about it, but like, it's no. So, you know, like, I really feel like Aziz Ansari would bring a powerful sense of realism to this.
And I am fully in support of that. And just last week, out of nowhere, because I haven't seen Master of None in months, I had that song Guarda Come Dondolo, that Italian song that he and his adorable Italian girlfriend danced to in that snowy apartment that one day, just popped in my head. And I was like, oh, this is like a great memory to have in my brain right now. So I am fully on board with Director Aziz of your wonderfully diverse and beautiful cast.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool cast. I want to see this movie. That Groove You Jammed.
Mike, who is your director? Oh, you already said the director, Jon Favreau.
Yeah, so, yep, still sticking with that.
I do root for him, though. He's super awesome.
I went with somebody I mentioned earlier who is a fan of this movie. I went with Damien Chazelle. Just like, he did a jazz movie, he can do another jazz movie, sort of. I think that he would work, again, keeping it boring and white boy, and I need to diversify my thing, diversify my bonds. I think that, you know, in terms of not an experimental movie, like, I think of the three of ours, Mike, no offense to either you or me, but like, the most interesting one would be Nico's. It might either be the biggest failure or the biggest success, but in terms of my cast and just sort of like making a movie that would work, I think Damien Chazelle could do that for this. So boring, but I think a safe pick.
No, I agree. I think he would bring more of like a style to it than Favreau would. Like, I think Favreau would play by the book a little more, and like, you know, it would be fun. It would probably be just like this, though. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wouldn't be like artistic much more than we're seeing Hanks pull. I think yours, guys, would definitely amp up some of like the cerebralism of it, or, you know, we'll feel the panic more when Guy can't make it to the studio on time or something. I don't know, but get more in your head as a director.
The only part that I almost gave to someone else, the only one I was really close on, was that the Liv Tyler role I almost gave to Alison Brie, which I think she would do a good job here too.
Alison Brie can do anything. Alison Brie, she's
amazing. Anything.
And plus, you know, we have Dave Franco on set, so they could, like, carpool to work together, because they're married, so it would be great. I was also trying to figure out, like, because, like, the way that I cast Dave Franco in the Steve Zahn role, and he basically doesn't interact with Liv Tyler, and I'm like, would that be weird for him, like, for a married couple to basically be in the same movie and be in every scene together, but, like, not talk to each other? And so, like, I sort of got in my head too much, and that's why I didn't go with her, but I think that she would be a great fit for this 2017 retelling of That Thing You Do.
Oh no, I have a regret.
What?
Oh, I would have made Mr. White female.
Well, we can recast your recast. Who would you rather have? Who is your Mrs. White?
I want Constance Zimmer.
Oh, Constance Zimmer. Yeah.
I love Constance Zimmer. Unreal is the fucking craziest. I love Unreal. Oh my God, it shakes me to my core every fucking episode.
Actually, speaking of Unreal, Shiri Appleby would be a great Liv Tyler in this too.
Shiri Appleby, I never would have imagined she is capable of what she is capable of.
She's so good in that show.
You could put her in any role. Through the performances they get out of it, they make Craig Bierko likable. That's unbelievable talent. I would definitely Constance Zimmer. She can.
Oh, that's totally wonderful.
She's got that perfect rasp that makes you believe that she could have fought her way through the music industry before women were allowed to wear pants.
Mike, if you don't know Unreal, or if anybody listening doesn't know Unreal, Unreal is a show on Lifetime. The only show that I watch on Lifetime.
Hey, Emmy nominated.
It's a scripted drama, a making of a Bachelor, Bachelorette show.
Oh.
And so Constance Zimmer is the showrunner, and Shiri Appleby plays her, not assistant, but, like, sort of her second in command,
like,
kind of,
exec.
But, like,
yeah.
They have a real love each other, hate each other relationship, and, like, it's all about, like, the manipulation behind the scenes of, like, making certain people progress, and, like, so Shiri Appleby plays a character named Rachel, and so I think in season two, or maybe, Nico, have there been two seasons or three seasons?
There have been two seasons in season three. We have a premiere date. It is January, I believe.
But in season two, there was a contestant that they called Hot Rachel.
Hot Rachel.
Who basically looked like Shiri Appleby,
Hot
but was
Rachel,
hotter.
Kevin, we're just talking about Unreal right now. It's the best conversation.
What did I just see recently? Oh, in Vice Principals, Lee Russell, Walton Goggins' sister, one of his sisters on that show, is the tall Christian redhead from the first season of Unreal. And I was like, Where do I know this woman from? I was like, oh my God! It's everywhere. Like, I would say check out Unreal. Unreal is, like, it's a show that I never thought I would love, and I really, really love.
Well, I love stories about behind the scenes of the industry.
And everybody's just so mean to everybody on that show.
The thing that it does the best of any TV show, I think and it's going to sound really unlikely, the two sources I think that are covering mental illness the best on TV are Unreal and Legion. They're the two shows that...
Legion.
Legion, like, look, in my best of the year that I did on Now and Again, I mentioned that I have this book and there's only 999 of them and I had to wait months and months and I spent way too much money on this book. It's Legion's first appearance. Like, David Holler isn't a character that means a little bit to me. He's a character that means a lot to me. And Legion is such a beautiful representation of the spirit of the character while not at all being the initial iteration. In a way, reimaginings like that usually take so much longer, and that and Unreal talk about mental illness in such a real, beautiful, honest way. Even though they're these grand ideas, they're the extraordinary set against the ordinary, there's something so humanizing about their treatment that I think it does make ordinary people feel more okay talking about their pain. That's Unreal and Legion in a heartbeat. Totally cut this. This is way too much, but 100%.
No, I'm leaving it in there, and I'm also adding in You're the Worst on FXX, which started out as a sort of a rom-com for millennials who kind of hate each other and sort of became this, like, beautiful description and, like, depiction of, like, depression and, like, PTSD. And, like, it's a show that, like, started out with just the R-rated rom-com that you've always wanted to see and then became this, like, amazing character study that, like, is just way better than you think it has any right to be. So I'm leaving this all in there. Go watch Unreal. Go watch Legion. Go watch You're the Worst. Pray that some Hollywood studio finds Watch the Throne and then somehow has the ability to make these movies. There's going to be three remakes of That Thing You Do. One with Aziz, one with Jon Favreau at the helm, and then one with my guy, Damien Chazelle, at the helm.
There'd be two remakes of That Thing You Do and one That Groove You Jam!
Oh, that's totally right.
I literally raise my knee and throw down my arms every time I have said it. Literally every single time I do, like, a dance move, because it's That Groove You Jam! It's too fun not to do.
Well, thank you so much, Nico, for being on the show. You can catch Nico most months on Now and Again. He is now the official semi-permanent co-host, where he gets to talk about the same producer he talks about on every episode.
Yep.
And also talk about Britney and Christina and boy bands and how am I blanking on the people that you talk about every episode? Janet Jackson.
You're doing it.
And
Tori Amos, Mariah Carey.
Tori Amos. Go listen to Nico there, and then Nico has a show or two coming out next year sometime. So stick around for that, because I'm very excited for those. But thank you, Nico, for joining us, being our first guest. You set the bar extraordinarily high for Watch the Throne. I hope people enjoyed you here, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I keep going to cut you off. I'm the worst. It means so much to me to get to pole vault these standards for you guys.
Yes. Mike, any last thoughts, grand thoughts, whatever, about that thing you do, or are we just ready for next week's Hollywood Confidential?
Yeah, I know. I'm ready to get to this Hollywood Confidential thing. This is the first time on Watch the Throne on the list of something that I've, like, I looked at the list, I was like, what the hell is this? So it should be a great episode next week.
Yeah, so for all things Watch the Throne, and Now and Again, and all of our other shows on the network, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter. Like I said, next Thursday, Boyfriend Material starts with La La Land, so if you want to hear two episodes about jazz movies, go do that. Go listen to Boyfriend Material. But cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, and at cageclubpod on Twitter. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Nico Vasillo, and we'll see you next time on Watch the Throne.